Hello and welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Ellen Grady, host of episode 12 in the series, which is Swords into Plowshares, a conversation with Martha Hennessy. Martha is the seventh child of Dorothy Day's only child, Tamar. She divides her time between the family farm in Vermont and volunteer work at Mary House Catholic Worker in New York City. Martha is a retired occupational therapist and grandmother of eight. She's been arrested and imprisoned protesting nuclear power, war, the use of drones, the torture of prisoners in Guantanamo and other prisons, and the use of starvation as a weapon of war in Yemen. She's traveled to Russia, Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Jordan, and Palestine to understand the effects of war on other peoples. Martha was one of seven Catholic Plowshares activists who entered Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in St. Mary's, Georgia, on April 4th, 2018. They went to make real the prophet Isaiah's command to beat swords into plowshares, thus the name of this episode. The seven chose to act on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who devoted his life to addressing what he called the triple evils of militarism, racism, and materialism. Carrying hammers and baby bottles of their own blood, the seven attempted to convert weapons of mass destruction. They hoped to call attention to the ways in which nuclear weapons kill every day by their mere existence and maintenance. This is the latest of 100 similar actions around the world, beginning in 1980 in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. So welcome, Martha.
Thank you for having me.
Martha, I wonder if you'd like to begin by talking about the issue of why you think you had to address the problem of our nuclear arsenal.
Well, I think Noam Chomsky has done a great job of pointing out the two catastrophic dangers we are now facing, global warming and nuclear holocaust. And we seem to be able to somewhat face the global warming, but we are just completely burying from the media and from our public conscience the whole issue of the nuclear arsenal. And there was an incident over New Year's where the U.S. STRATCOM, Strategic Command Air Force, sent out what they thought was a funny tweet. And of course, this happened quite recently, and I made the decision to participate in Plowshares some time ago. But I do see and feel the urgency of now. And the tweet said, "Times Square tradition rings in the new year by dropping the big ball. If ever we need it, we are ready to drop something much, much bigger." So wake up, folks. We have been practicing this nuclearism for over 70 years, and I grew up with the full understanding of what that looked like and what that meant, reading John Hershey's Hiroshima as a child. And so it's my responsibility, the primacy of my conscience as a Catholic, the fact that God's love is written on my heart, the fact that I needed to take a long life's journey and come to a place of understanding the promise of my own baptism and what that meant for me as a Catholic and as a woman to stand up to this horrific evil that we all seem to be sleepwalking towards.
Yeah. You know, Martha, I was just remembering when you were talking about the STRATCOM tweet, I was remembering when you said that about last year at this time, January 13th, there was a false ballistic missile alert that was issued via the emergency alert system in Hawaii. And for about, I think it was about 30 minutes, people were given this false alarm. And it was this sense of like, in the reading that I did afterwards, you know, people really, really thought that this was actually happening. And it was this moment for several people where they thought, oh my God, what have we been doing? Why have we not, you know, like we sort of have been lulled into thinking that nuclear weapons are just not a big deal until actually you get this false alert. And then you're like, oh my God, we're all going to die in just minutes, right? Anyway, so I was just thinking about that happened last year, right at this time before your action happened. And I'm sure that was probably something that was part of your contemplating, but I don't know. I'm guessing it. I mean, maybe you don't remember that. Do you remember? Oh, because you lived in Hawaii, didn't you?
Yes, I knew of it immediately, and I heard from people in Hawaii immediately, and it's pretty horrifying.
Yeah.
And it, just the combination of so many things happening in the last 2 years, you know, even prior to Trump's election, all dripping concerns slowly and how quickly this can escalate. And we also have the history of the broken arrow, history of all of the near misses.
Yes.
And, you know, that's certainly for me, if God didn't hear some of us praying, please don't let us do this to ourselves.
Yeah.
I think that's why we're still here.
It's sort of miraculous these times when people have chosen, you know, in positions to press that button that didn't do it when there was these false alarms, which is kind of miraculous that they chose not to. The story of the man in Russia who just passed away, I think, who made that decision not to press the bomb when it looked like we had incoming missiles coming in to Russia. And also, I remember last year at this time, also with Trump threatening North Korea, and there was such real scary things that were happening in terms of him coming into power and really thinking that and making statements that we could use these weapons is quite terrifying. I was reading an article about North Korea and the North Koreans. Well, actually, it was also the South Koreans. There was actually footage, I believe, on Democracy Now! Where these students were blockading the U.S. I forget who it was that was over. I think it was Ambassador. And they were just so angry with us for making these statements and realizing that it's their lives, you know, that North Korea, that if anything happened, that they would be some of the first people to go.
And I was in Seoul last year, and the end of November, beginning of December, for the first ever Catholic Peace Conference. And yes, they know exactly what they're faced with. I mean, yeah. The United States already destroyed the peninsula with the Korean War.
Yeah.
And yes, Trump has made it very clear what his intentions are.
Yeah. And now pulling out of the medium range nuclear missile treaty. I forget the title of that treaty.
INF.
INF, thank you. Well, Martha, I wonder if you could talk about why did you address your concerns in this way through a Plowshares action?
Well, we've seen so much failure in terms of our government, in terms of our institutions, including the church, in terms of our peace movement, in terms of our social movements, our social awareness, the economic model, even the energy and environmental models that we insist on pursuing that are so destructive. This particular action to me felt like accumulation of my faith journey. And I do consider what we did to be a prophetic act and also a sacramental act. And we talk about this in our pretrial defense. We are using the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is not good law, but we will do our best to improve it. And nothing like putting your body where the great sin and crime is, and nothing like pouring your blood in an act of atonement, an act of contrition, an act of understanding the sacredness of life, and understanding the abomination of what Naval Submarine Base at Kings Bay represents. And it was just a great privilege for me to be able to participate with this community and my friends.
Wow, that's beautiful. When you were speaking about it, it made me think. I was part of a plashers action in 1982 against the Trident submarine when it was being built at Electric Boat Shipyard in Groton, Connecticut. And I remember contemplating possibly not doing this action, and partly because I was very nervous and very scared about the idea of having to go to jail, but more about having to go to court. It terrified me to think about having to go to court. And I thought to myself, I can't do this. I will not be profound. I will not be able to articulate this clearly enough, and I can't do it. I can't do it. And then I had this realization that I was choosing not to try to convert a nuclear weapon into a plowshares because of my ego. And I thought, no, I'm getting this opportunity to begin this process, which is just a small process, right? It's just a beginning, right? You know, I'm not strong enough to convert that giant, you know, the Trident submarine, just to tell our guests, are 2 football fields long and 4 stories high. They're huge. They're huge submarines. But that these little dings that we put in them, or that I put in that component, and that you put as you began, you know, at the site of the planning for these things, that they're the beginning of that process, right? So, So anyway, I thought, wow, that helped clarify for me that actually I did want to do this action. So
it's the little way, the tiny pebble.
Yeah. But also that I didn't need to be, yes, of course I needed to know what I was doing and what that was about, but that I didn't need to be afraid of court and that I needed to answer that call. That call was greater than that fear of court. So anyway. But back to some questions that I have for you. What do you think helped you prepare for taking such steps like this in terms of this action?
Thank you. I can't help but think of Megan Rice, because the Transform Now Plowshares, who did their action in 2012, Megan came to a place of saying, my whole life prepared me for this. And so I kind of steal that line from Megan, Sister Megan. You know, growing up in a large family, growing up in the Catholic worker community, raising 3 children, taking care of children in my profession of occupational therapy, even being a gardener, all of these things have contributed to my preparation. And then, of course, going to Mary House and to work there. I had not stepped foot in Mary House for 20 years after Dorothy's death.
Could you describe what Mary House is, just a little tiny bit?
It's in Lower Manhattan, 3rd Street, the House of Hospitality where my grandmother died. My mother was with her. And I had to return to the Catholic Church, and then I returned to the Catholic Worker, and then I found myself in a plowshares discernment. So I don't know. This is all a mystery. Conversions are mysteries. And, you know, I just tried to live within my community and tried to listen to the voice of God in instructing me. So I can't necessarily fully explain myself.
You're listening to episode 12 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is Swords into Plowshares, a conversation with Martha Hennessy. I'm Ellen Grady, host of this episode. Well, it sounds like, as you so beautifully were doing, is bringing in all the threads of the different pieces of your life that prepared you. And some of that is mystery, is what you said. You know, it's mystery why that happened that way. But I think Dan Berrigan used to speak about it's the geography of your faith. And I think that it's where you put yourself. So if you put yourself at Mary House, or you put yourself with children, and you see the preciousness of life, or you see the results of what poverty does to people, and you question the reasons why there is this great poverty, and you see the results, as you've talked about, or we talked about in the introduction, of what our war making has done to people, that moves you to another understanding or a deeper understanding. And that's what the geography of your faith is about, right? You know, that if we don't put ourselves in those situations, we don't understand. We can continue to go on sort of
deluding ourselves.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't have to touch our very comfortable lives. And especially as people of, you know, middle-class white people, you know, and I know that your background, you know, that you were not middle class even in how much money you had, but you know, in terms of your values and your how much reading you had and all that things that you had access to.
Yes.
And you know, and that privilege that we have, and if we don't ever step out of those places of privilege and to try to understand more deeply, then it doesn't bring you to those places. So I love your idea that it's all these strands that have led you to take this action, and it's what prepared you to take the action.
It's a leap of faith, a blind leap of faith sometimes.
Yeah, it is. And so that's, as we were going over some thoughts about what we would talk about today, we talked about what are the influences in your life that brought you to this place of readiness to do such an action. And, you know, we sort of touched on that just a minute ago, but maybe there's more.
No, I would just say, you know, other than community and family and, of course, the culture that we grow up in certainly impacts who we become. There's just also that divine mystery of one's capacity. You know,
yeah.
we're all given gifts, and it is a mystery how we, you know, in our lives first recognize maybe what those gifts are, and then understand that those gifts are to be shared with others. And so I'm just incredibly grateful that finally something hit me over the head and dragged me by the hair to live the way I'm living now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about one of these great influences in your life, and that would be your granny. A little bit of her conversion, and then a little bit about just her deeper understanding of Catholic social teaching and how that resonated so much with her and her understanding of what her faith called her to do.
Thank you. Dorothy converted to Catholicism as an adult after giving birth to my mother, and it was a lonely experience. I mean, she was well embedded in community and closeness to others throughout her entire life. She was a mystic. But it was the Catholic Church that did pull her in because of, you know, the history of the New York City culture of Italians, Poles, Irish, you know, the Catholics were the poor people, were the masses. And that certainly attracted her. But it was Peter Maurin, you know, 5 years into her conversion, she was still trying to understand how to apply her gifts and her vocation of a writer. She was a very talented writer, and she was a journalist, as were her father and brothers. And so it was Peter Maurin who brought her to the Catholic social teachings and the newspaper, and then the outgrowth of Houses of Hospitality from Peter and Dorothy's program with the newspaper to comment on the issues and concerns of the day of the worker. And so it's an incredible story. It's a beautiful story. And it's an unfolding story, even today, 85 years after the founding of the Catholic Worker. And yes, being born into that certainly had a profound effect on all of us.
I was just going to say, I remember my dad saying that when he was in college, in Manhattan College in the Bronx there, one of his teachers spoke about Dorothy Day, and he was so moved by her witness and her reflections that he did have her come up and speak at Manhattan College. That would have been in the late 40s, early 50s sometime. I'm not sure the exact date. But
so you and I go way back, Ellen.
Exactly, Martha. We go way, way back, and little did we know. And the same for my mom, who was living in Chicago. Her sister said, "You have to come hear this woman speak. She's amazing." So, and I don't know around what year that would have been, but it would have been probably similar timing. So your granny had a lot of influence on a lot of people, and these young Catholics were so on fire with her influence. So we have a lot of us have a lot to be thankful for the work and writing of Dorothy Day. And for our listeners, my parents, John and Teresa Grady, were part of the Catholic Worker as well as the Catholic, what they called the Catholic Left, and were very, very involved with issues around civil rights and war and peace. And my father was part of one of the draft board raids called the Camden 28, and all inspired by some of the work of Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton and the Berrigans. And so my parents committed their whole lives to that work. So when I refer to them being inspired by Dorothy, that would be some of the roots that they had. It came from Dorothy's work. Martha, I'm wondering if you could describe your thoughts and feelings with these phases of nuclear resistance, the preparation for the action that you took, and then could you then describe the action, and then talk about jail and court, and maybe prison time if you're found guilty. So those sort of different phases.
Thank you. I would say that I was 6 years trying to discern whether I should be part of a plowshares action. And then I would say, you know, I was invited to participate in the two previous ones to ours. But, you know, my mother was still alive in 2007. She died in 2008. Mm-hmm. I was concerned about her hurting her with, you know, subjecting myself to trauma. And then I would say, 2 years in direct discernment. And up until the very moment, I was still not 100% clear or sure that I could follow through. And so the preparation was both painful and arduous, but also incredibly beautiful and liberating. It's hard to describe, you know, both the preparation and the action itself. You know, one never overcomes fear. It's a question of controlling it. You never eliminate the fear. It's a question of gaining enough courage to override the fear. You know, the fear of being mutilated or killed, the fear of being ostracized, the fear of failure. So many reasons to be fearful in this world. And Dorothy did speak and write a lot about how fear controls us. And so it was prayer. It was simply prayer and community that kept me putting one foot in front of the other. And even on the base, in the dark, putting one foot in front of the other. And feeling this incredible sense of God is with us. You know, you can only do what you feel is the right thing to do. And then, of course, we spent 2 months in jail, county jail in South Georgia. And that was just a whole other education. How our judicial system functions, doesn't function. The incredible, immense suffering of others. The class warfare that this country is built upon. The racism, classism, the misogyny, the whole works. It's all right there. And so we had to find our community there, right then and there. And so it's extremely difficult, but it's also extremely valuable and beautiful. And I love the quote that Dorothy took from Dostoevsky, the Russian writer. You know, love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing. But it is love. It is love and it is beauty. And of course, when we deal with the courts, we are bringing them into this story and into this pilgrimage. And Steve Kelly stated that beautifully in one of our recent hearings, that, you know, now the narrative includes you, Judge. And so this is what we do. We tell stories and we bring each other into these stories, and we must have dialogue. We must have diplomacy, not bombing. We must have talks. You want to talk about democracy? You want to talk about having decent civilization? We must talk to each other.
Yep.
And so the whole court experience, and then the future potential prison time, all of that is a time of retreat, time in the desert, time of study, time of, you know, I'm 63 years old, and I have perhaps 20 years left to my life. And so I just have to continue to think about what is that tiny voice in my heart and in my ear, and can I abide by it, and can I allow it to guide me? And this whole idea of the federal prison system now being in shutdown with this government shutdown impacting the lack of staff in these prisons. I mean, I'm full of all kinds of fears.
Yeah.
You know, I have health issues at my age. I have lived my entire life on this incredible farm with this sweet soil and eating this most delicious food. And so I will be subjected to the worst aspects of our culture. And how to do that voluntarily and with grace. I beg for God's mercy.
So, you know, Martha, I know that you're facing 4 charges and 3 of them felonies, and facing up to 25 years in prison as a maximum sentence that you could receive. I'm wondering if you could describe the charges that you're facing.
Well, trespass, of course, which is the only misdemeanor. And, you know, trespass. Well, I paid my war taxes. I bought a share in that evil place.
Mm-hmm.
It's my responsibility to address that.
Yep.
Conspiracy, of course, and those of us who live and breathe together and pray together, we certainly consider that this kind of an act cannot be done without breathing and praying together. And the government loves to accuse us of conspiracy, when in fact I think the greatest conspiracy is what they started with the Manhattan Project, duping the entire nation. And then the other 2 charges of depredation of governmental property or destruction of naval property, I might have mixed those 2 up. And of course, you know, that whole argument of calling warheads that deliver the end of all life, calling that property, you know, I just simply beg to differ and to point out, you know, they're not proper to the common good. They are not property. This whole business of the Manhattan Project and the nuclear bomb duping the entire nation, we set our minds and our faces to a project that we did not fully understand. And the government, you know, took the money, took the resources, took the labor, took the treasure, the brain trust, and applied it to this project of empire. And I think to a certain extent, the nation knew that this was happening, but not enough on a level to fully understand the implications. And so another reason why we take this action is to wake the people up to what we are actually facing. It's so easy to deceive ourselves. And so our whole economy is now based on war making, and we don't want to face that, and we don't want to admit that.
You're listening to episode 12 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is Swords into Plowshares, a conversation with Martha Hennessy. I'm Ellen Grady, host of this episode. Right, if people actually really knew, and if we really paused and we understood what we spend on war and what we spend on nuclear weapons, you know, over 50% of our taxes go to past wars, as well as military spending now, as well as building weapons and maintaining these weapons and storing these weapons. And just think of what we could do with those kind of resources in this country that people are struggling so much right now, living from paycheck to paycheck. If they get that paycheck, you know, it's really hard. And it's
hand to mouth, as my mother would say.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the sin of all those resources going into basically paying for death. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the action and what it was that you guys did there at the naval base in Georgia. And actually, before you do that, I wanted to point out to our listeners that you guys have a website, and it's called KingsBayPlowshares7.org.
Numeral 7.
Yes, right. Numeral 7, exactly. But anyway, yes, could you describe a little bit about the action and what you all did?
We brought Dan Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, and left it there.
Can you tell us what that book is?
Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers has recently finished it's somewhat biographical, but it's his story about he had papers and documents to a story much greater and much grimmer than just simply the Pentagon Papers regarding the Vietnam War. He was engaged in helping to create policy that would make the use of the nuclear arsenal possible. And of course, he had a conversion. And the Doomsday Machine does a beautiful job of documenting his work and what we are faced with in terms of the government and the military's actual intention and use of this arsenal. This arsenal has been used over the decades in many different ways. Mm-hmm. And so this book, The Doomsday Machine, documents all of that, and it's a must-read for any of us who care to understand the history. We also left an indictment, Kings Bay Plowshares versus the United States,
mm-hmm.
talking about fighting a dragon with a toothpick.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, here we have this indictment that talks about the U.S. Constitution itself, the laws of the U.S., the treaties, all of these things that the United Nations Charter, all of these things that a civilized people have put in place after experiencing horrific world wars and World Wars I and II, and how we continue to violate all of these. So the indictment was very critical. We put up crime tape. We poured our blood. We symbolically hammered on these mock-up missiles. We called it the Missile Shrine. I myself personally went to the Strategic Weapons Facility Atlantic Administration Building, and that's where we posted the indictment and spread the crime tape. And the missile shrine, which was dedicated to showing all of the different models, the evolution, or shall we say devolution, of these devil-like implements, the missile shrine. And it was there that we hammered and poured blood and taped up the banners. The ultimate logic of Trident is omnicide, and the ultimate logic of racism is genocide, Martin Luther King Jr.'s quote.
You spray painted also? Did you just say that? I missed it.
Yes. May love disarm us all and abolish nukes now and love one another. And this is idolatry. I forget what all everyone contributed.
So this word omnicide, you don't hear that word very much. And so I actually went and looked it up in the dictionary because I was like, I mean, I've had several people say, what does that mean, omnicide? And so I looked it up. It said the total extinction of the human species as a result of human action. Most commonly, it refers to human extinction through nuclear warfare, but it can also refer to such extinction through other means such as global anthropogenic ecological catastrophe. Its first known use was in 1959. So this idea of omnicide has come about in the 20th century because of our capacity to destroy all life on Earth as we know it. I'm wondering, can you tell me what it was like when the police or the base military arrested you?
Well, we had other friends at the fence where the warheads were actually kept, the bunkers. And that took everyone on the base's full attention. So we were ignored for probably 2 hours, maybe less than that, I don't know. My sense of time was suspended. But people were driving past us to go to the other site, of course.
You mean the people meaning the military?
Yeah.
I see.
People who run the base, who are responsible for the so-called security of those warheads. And so by the time we were approached, you know, we said to ourselves, well, maybe we should walk over to where everybody else is. But no, we stayed put at the missile shrine. And then the gentleman who finally approached us was incredibly courteous. He had two other young soldiers in training with him, and he was impeccable in his professionalism, in his modeling to them. And there was no violence whatsoever. And we were handcuffed and taken in cars to the holding place on the base and held for a few hours and then sent on into the hands of the Camden County Sheriff's Department.
It's my understanding that you all wrote a letter to the Pope, that you as a community wrote a letter to the Pope, and I'm wondering why you did that specifically, but also what it was that you said to Pope Francis.
It was a letter of petition and supplication. I'm sorry, I don't have a copy in front of me. Mark Colville did a beautiful job of composing most of that. And we know that all of the popes, since the dawn of the nuclear age, have said, this is evil, we must not pursue this.
Mm-hmm.
So even in 1943, before the dropping of the bomb, Pope Pius XII, I think, I may have that wrong, stated that you know, this is a great evil and we should not be developing this kind of weaponry. And so we petitioned Pope Francis. He has said on more than one occasion, and in fact most recently, that the manufacture, production, storage, the threat to use these weapons is completely immoral. And so as Christians, we have to examine ourselves and we have to decide, how do we call ourselves Christians?
Mm-hmm.
And Dorothy once stated, you know, the great scandal is that these nuclear weapons, the vast majority of these weapons, are in the hands of white Christians, the Russians and the U.S. And so Pope Francis certainly supports us, and we wanted to go on record. I mean, I'm sure he supports our motives and intentions. I have no idea how he feels about our delivery system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Of the message.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're practicing Catholics and we wanted to clearly state to the Pope that, you know, I truly believe that the United States, being the sole rogue superpower in 2019, that the U.S. Catholic bishops play a critical, key role in changing what is happening. I would just like to quote, Chris Hedges has written an article for Truth Dig about the Catonsville Nine action and about the Berrigan brothers, and he also included a bit of the Kings Bay action. But I just want to read one sentence. The Berrigans excoriated the church hierarchy for sacralizing the nation, the government, capitalism, the military, and the war. They argued that the fusion of secular and religious authority would kill the church as a religious institution. I was out of the church most of my adult life. I am now back in the church, and I will never have my faith taken away from me. Right now, the U.S. Catholic Church is submerged in scandal, and there is much more to come. And this is regarding the rape of children, but it's also regarding the relationship with power and wealth. And so I believe Pope Francis is doing his best, and I just wanted to respond to his call. All of us did.
If anybody wants to see that letter, that website again is KingsBayPlowshares7.org. KingsBayPlowshares7.org. So there's a lot of information. The indictment that you spoke about is also there, as well as the statement that you all wrote before you went into the base, as well as this letter to Pope Francis. And a lot of the legal updates are there as well. And Martha, you spoke about the legal approach that you're about to do with RFRA, which is the
Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Thank you. So the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is one approach that you're taking in your defense. One thing that was confusing to me, and then it was made clear to me by one of your lawyers, Bill Quigley, out of New Orleans. Bill Quigley explained that in August, you all presented a motion to dismiss, and there were several things in that motion, reasons for why the motion should be dismissed, and why you all should be, your case should be dismissed. And one of them was international law that you spoke about. One of them was the justification, and one of them was this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And so the way Bill Quigley explained it, many times judges will just sort of deny that motion and proceed on with choosing a court date and all that kind of stuff. But this particular judge wanted to know more about this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And so it's my understanding that the seven of you each had to write an affidavit explaining your deeply held religious beliefs and why what you did at the base was a religious act. So that's what the fall has been taken up with you writing and then having court hearings. So I was wondering if you could talk about the court hearing a little bit and about the people who testified besides yourselves. I know that you had a couple of expert witnesses testify also to support your contention. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, we had evidentiary hearing, and that was on November 7th and 19th of 2018. And we had, you know, seven co-defendants who needed to give testimony. And we had two expert witnesses brought in Brunswick, Georgia, at the courthouse. And we were trying to present evidence to support our religious defense. We brought in a professor from Fordham University by the name of Janine Hill Fletcher, and she laid out beautifully how Catholic social teaching calls us to take action and how this was indeed a sacramental act of bringing Christ to a place of great suffering and great sin. And we also had one bishop who agreed to come, and that was Bishop Joseph Kopatz from Jackson, Mississippi. And he also testified regarding the connection between our practice of our faith and the willingness to take action to condemn nuclear holocaust. You know, God has written on our hearts to love one another, to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so this was our love in action. And the government called two witnesses, the commander of the base, of course, and the public relations person who had to report to the public after this incident occurred, and who very graciously said to the Washington Post, "At no time was anyone under threat or danger." So that will be helpful in our defense as nonviolent activists. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And all of the co-defendants testified very powerfully, very beautifully, you know, explaining that they do have a sincerely held belief as Catholics, and that it was their responsibility and necessity to act on that faith, and that our system should allow for this kind of religious act. So this is all very groundbreaking effort in the Plowshares movement.
You're listening to episode 12 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is Swords into Plowshares, a conversation with Martha Hennessy. I'm Ellen Grady, host of this episode. It's my understanding, Martha, that the case is at the point where the judge will be making a decision about this freedom of religion in conjunction with this motion to dismiss, and that the judge has not made a ruling yet, that the defense and the prosecution has to present some more evidence to the court. But several things can come out of the ruling on the part of the judge, and it's my understanding that it could be that this motion to dismiss would be granted on the count of RFRA, or...
Very unlikely.
Very unlikely. I mean, any of these are very unlikely, but that's what you've been working at. That's the stage that this still is in, right?
Yes.
Nobody has ruled on that motion that was made back in August, because there's still evidence going in. And you just spoke about what you all presented and a little bit of what the government presented. Because part of this RFRA is that the government uses the least restrictive means. So giving you charges, first of all, some of them repetitive, and second of all, that they're charging you with 25 years worth of charges doesn't seem like the least restrictive means that they could be using. So the judge could say that actually you need to use less charges. Another possibility is that the judge will say, no, this will all stand, but you can talk about RFRA in court during your trial. Or the judge will say, it's all denied and we're not going to let you talk about any of this at all. So that's the stage that you're at with the court proceedings, is my understanding. And that they will hear this maybe by mid-February. Is that correct? Do I have that understanding?
We're still in the process of providing a supplemental brief, which is a summary of the evidentiary hearing. And all of this work is due to the court by January 16th. And then it will take 1 to 3 weeks for the court to respond. And they will respond with any of those possibilities you just outlined, and potentially and hopefully set a trial date if it's not all dismissed. And then it is at that point where we will know how to prepare for trial, depending upon whether they have stripped us of any defense that we would possibly use. So perhaps the trial will start in mid to late February in Brunswick, Georgia.
I see. And if people wanted to come to that trial, is it open to the public?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
We expect a large crowd.
So my understanding is that you'll have information up on the website as that time gets a little closer, as you learn about when the trial date will be. So people can go to the website, and that website again is kingsbayplowshares7.org, and that 7 is the numeral 7. I actually was there for some of the court hearing, and I was so moved by the testimony by you all, and particularly Janine Hill Fletcher was amazing in her explanation of Catholic social teaching, as you just described. It was really exciting to hear her speak. And there was one guy in the courtroom who was an atheist. And he goes, well, if that's really what the church is about, I want to be part of that church. So, you know, and as Peter Morin, the co-founder of the Catholic Worker, would say, you know, there's dynamite within that church, and the church is sitting on the lid. So let's open it up and let's let that light shine out.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, that was beautiful. I'm also struck by court and the court system and how hard it is to be in court. And it was interesting to read that Chris Hedges article, and he quotes a lot of Dan Berrigan's writing. And this one really struck me, this quote, and it's about court and Berrigan's assessment of what court is about. And he says, "For you cannot set up a court in the kingdom of the blind to condemn those who see, a court presided over by those who would pluck out the eyes of men and call it rehabilitation." I was like, oh my God, that's such a great quote. Dan Berrigan, what a poet. But I wanted you to speak a little bit about your co-defendants. And two of them have been in since April. That would be Liz McAllister, sister-in-law of Daniel Berrigan, and Father Steve Kelly, Jesuit priest from California. And the third person who's still in right now is Mark Colville, who had to come out for a short period of time to have some health procedure taken care of. But I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit about each of your co-defendants and where they're from, and yeah, share that.
Oh, thank you. Well, Elizabeth McAllister just turned 79 years old in the Glynn County Jail in Brunswick, Georgia. And she is the widow of Phil Berrigan, and as you said, sister-in-law of Dan. She is, you know, our matriarch. She is our Bible study expert. I was literally at her feet in our tiny cell that the three of us stayed in Camden County, Georgia. We did the daily readings, and she is just such an inspiration. and such a loving presence. She herself is a grandmother, and she has been there for 8 months, and I pray for her daily. And Steve Kelly, he was the one who gave the homily at Dan Berrigan's funeral, and it was such an incredible homily, such a beautiful call to action. And this was in April of 2015, I think, is when Dan died.
Yep.
And then we have Mark Koval of the New Haven Amistad Catholic Worker, father of four, and they do the daily work of running a house of hospitality, caring for the poor, feeding the poor. And we have Carmen Trotta, a very long-term participant and member of the New York Catholic Worker, St. Joseph's House on First Street, where I used to visit Granny in the summers. And we also have Claire, your sister, Claire Grady, who lives in Ithaca, New York, who has also participated in previous Plowshares action. And, you know, the strength, the wisdom, and the courage of all of these people just on a daily basis continues to astound me.
Mm-hmm.
And Patrick O'Neill, who is a father of eight and grandfather of two now, since our action, he has become a grandfather twice over. And he's in Garner, North Carolina, running a Catholic worker house down there as well. And so I just can't express my joy and gratitude and respect for this little community.
Beautiful. Well, I wonder if you could speak a little bit, Martha, about your family and how your family and community has responded to your participation in this action.
It's hard. It's not easy. Oh, at least I waited until my mother died. But it's been so hard on my husband, of course, because I'm away a lot. And our daughter lives right next door here on the farm. She was born here. And now her children, my three grandchildren, are right next door, and they're growing up here. And it's a very beautiful, wonderful thing. And my absence impacts a lot of people, of course. We have this little community here of seven, and then my niece and nephew, who just had a baby last week, are right across the field where my brother raised his kids. And, of course, Mary House. I've been doing a lot of work at Mary House, and it's not easy, but I do feel a great sense of love and a great sense of support. In the long run, everyone understands the sacrifice and the necessity. And in the short run, they just bear with it. And, you know, there is a certain level of complaint, necessarily. None of us are perfect.
Yeah.
But in general, it's sad but joyful at the same time, if you can understand that.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's part of that harsh and dreadful thing that Dorothy talks about in terms of love. And as you said, it's sad and it's hard. And it's also beautiful and full of joy. And it sounds like when you described the night of the action, you know, there was both things going on at the same time for you. And I think that that's an important message for all of us to know. It's like it's not all going to be just la-di-da, right? It's work, it's struggle.
Yeah.
My mother used to say about birth, because culturally, you know, we see in movies and stuff, it's women are so often just shown to be out of control and not be able to deal with it. And not just in movies, but we know that has for years and years, women were knocked out and drugged and told that they can't do it, right? And my mother used to say, it's not pain. It's something else than pain. It's work. She said that to us, I think partly because she didn't want us to be afraid of what that was. And, you know, having birthed four children, I can say I did experience pain, but there's something different about it as you're bringing this life into the world, and that there's something about tapping into that greater source. And I feel like that's when you describe the action, that's what that is. You're tapping into something, you're going deeper. And it's this faith that you have and allowing for God's Spirit to come through you and to walk with you. And you're not sugarcoating it.
Right.
There is pain, but there's also this great joy. So I'm wondering if you could talk about your hopes and dreams for the future.
Yeah, this is a discussion that I think is ongoing. You know, the dialogue of, is there any hope? And the cynicism that goes on about making the necessary changes that we need to make, changes that are needed for our very existence. And as a Catholic, I am brought to practice faith, hope, and love. And so I see a future. I mean, as a gardener, I'm already seeing the deterioration in the environment around me. As a grandmother, I'm already seeing the impact of technology on the human species. There's plenty to be cynical and hopeless about. But I am ever hopeful that the vast majority of people want what is right, recognize and understand what is right and what is just, and that we do have the solutions at our fingertips. And it's a question of a conversion of the heart, a revolution of the heart, of gaining hearts of flesh as opposed to hearts of stone, where we finally decide, okay, yes, we are made in the image of God, and we are here to love one another as we love God. And I have plenty of atheistic friends who talk about religion being the problem. And, you know, I have anarchist friends who talk about government being the problem. And I do have faith that we can develop an economic and social system, an ecological approach that celebrates life on earth and God's creation. I believe in the Garden of Eden coming back.
I'm host Ellen Grady, and you've been listening to episode 12 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is Swords into Plowshares. We spoke with Martha Hennessy on January 3rd, 2019. You can find this episode and the entire Nonviolent Direct Action series on iTunes. You can find related links on our blog, nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.